You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, early voting is underway for the midterm elections. We'll talk to a political scientist about what could happen if control of the House, Senate, or both changes parties. Now, as the seasons change, so does our cooking. Our next guest is here with a bunch of ideas on how to incorporate fresh local ingredients into comforting fall dishes and to keep the fun and comfort in our kitchens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite things to make this time of year? What's on the menu tonight or this weekend? Is there a piece of fall produce that you always look forward to? And what is the ideal complexity of a recipe for you? Really fancy and fussy and highfalutin, or something you can handle, easy and fun? Maybe a little biased there. I don't know. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer Rood-Klett is a freelance writer focused on Midwestern history, gardening, and food. She's the author of the cookbook Home Cooking Comeback. Her latest cookbook is called Home Cooking Comfort: More Neighborly Advice and Recipes from the Farm Kitchen of a Midwestern Food Journalist. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be back on Central Time with Rob.
Yeah. And now there's two things I want to look at before we start checking out recipes. One, and I already knew this, you love using local seasonal ingredients. What are you excited about in the fall for local seasonal stuff?
Well, both cookbooks feature all foods grown, raised, or produced in Wisconsin. So it's very Midwestern, very Wisconsin cookbook. And in the fall, we look to root vegetables, apples, of course. And I like to incorporate a lot of oats with meals. So late crops of spinach and some of the cold crop things, soups, dry beans, chili. Rolls, this is the time of year when people can't wait to get inside and fire up the oven.
And why do you like cooking with seasonal stuff as much as possible?
Oh, because it provides the home cook with the absolute best possible outcome, without a doubt.
And you're really encouraging people to cook, period. You worry that we've gotten a little too in the habit of, restaurants, which are fine, and convenience foods, which you want to see us cook a little more or a lot more.
Yeah, I sure do. Home cooking is a skill, and it's kind of fallen off of late. A lot of young people don't know how to cook. And, when I wrote the cookbooks, I tried to keep the novice home cook in mind. And I know a lot of people have been trying it since the pandemic. But I also encourage people that have been cooking a long time to stay teachable, because I know from all the newspaper stories I've written, every single story I've written about food, and so many interviews I've done with food producers, I learn something every single time. So I would urge people to remain teachable. The other thing that's really timely right now is that the costs of everything are going up so much. And I like going out for a Friday fish fry as much as the next person, but to cook at home, you can really save a lot of money doing it that way.
And another thing that I love about the book is, we can watch a lot of shows on TV where cooks are making this amazing looking stuff. And we might open a cookbook and there are these like brilliant, artistically laid out pictures of the fancy meal. You say we shouldn't be comparing ourselves. We can be okay with not being perfect in our cooking.
Absolutely. Home cooking is meant to be imperfect. It's by its very nature. Unfortunately, perfection has been thrust upon us so much in the society, and home cooking is, by its, again, nature, very imperfect.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Jennifer Rood-Klett about her new cookbook, Home Cooking Comfort: More Neighborly Advice and Recipes from the Farm Kitchen of a Midwestern Food Journalist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What seasonal Wisconsin food are you enjoying? Maybe right now or planning to enjoy this weekend? What says comfort food to you in the fall? What do you love to cook or eat if someone else is cooking? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, we've got some recipes from Jennifer. You can find them at wpr.org/foodfriday. And Jennifer, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to start with dessert today, because you gave us a dessert recipe and you actually brought some of these in for us here. Oat cookies with browned butter cinnamon frosting.
Yeah, these have become the ultimate fall cookie. I've made them a lot recently. And, you know, I have to tell you, Rob, that this is the first time I've ever brought in a sample from something from the cookbook.
Oh, no.
And everywhere I go, people say, did you bring samples? And I say, no, I want you to cook at home. This is the goal here. But I felt that you broadcasting people here needed a little pick-me-up, it being Friday afternoon, and we've been working hard all week.
Yes, well, and we do love our delicious treats here at Wisconsin Public Radio, for sure. Now, here's the oats you were talking about, and you're a big fan of oats. They're kind of a humble food, but can you talk about the versatility? What kind of different things can we do with our oats?
Yeah, I would encourage anybody to incorporate as many oats as you can in your recipes. And amazingly, oats were once shunned for human consumption. They were thought of as livestock feed, and they eventually became a food staple in Northern Europe, Ireland, Scandinavia, Germany, Switzerland, and came to North America in the 1600s. And it was an amazing nourishment for both of, for our soldiers during both of the world wars. Wisconsin is ranked number one for oat production. I did not know that prior to doing this story.
I should know that.
Yeah, according to the USDA, and it also ranks first for number of farms growing organic oats, although a lot of that actually still goes to livestock. So for home cooks, you can encounter oats in many forms. The whole grain oat is called a groat, which is kind of a weird name. And if you cut that groat two or three times, you've got steel-cut oats is what you commonly see it as. And the home cook is probably very familiar with rolled oats. And the difference between the three is kind of the cooking time and the texture. And, of course, oats can be ground up and be used as flour, but there's no gluten in that, so you have to be careful if you are wanting a rise out of whatever you're baking.
My favorite go-to for oats is crisps, fruit crisps, apple crisp, peach, I mean, you name it. Throwing some oats and flour and butter together, that's like so easy. Like, I can do that by memory now. I haven't looked at the recipe in years.
Yeah, and one thing I should mention too, all of the information about my cookbooks are available on Amazon.com and at my website at jrootklet.com. There's direct links to purchase the cookbooks. And with oats, you know, typically you find rolled oats in the supermarket and they're fine. But if you ever head out to a farmer's market, especially tomorrow with some of the last ones going on, or even a winter's farmer's market is a good source for this. If you can score some local rolled oats or any type of oats, buy them because they are so much better. What happens when big manufacturers roll the oats, they often steam them and that extends the shelf life. So they're minimally processed and they're fresh and they're local. And there's quite a few oak producers, growers in the state. So if you can, they're going to be more expensive, but in my book, they're worth it. So if you can find them, buy them.
That reminds me, another ingredient you are excited about, and who wouldn't be? Garlic. And this is something we can pick up in Wisconsin this time of year. Talk about getting that fresh local garlic in the state.
So I did a story for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel last August, and that's right when the fresh garlic season begins. And I had previously used garlic in fresh garlic in my cooking, but I discovered that people go absolutely crazy over garlic. And the story ran right before a couple of big farms, or I should say a couple of smaller farms, had their big garlic sale opening up. And it caused almost a panic, on a run on garlic. People were just panicked that they weren't going to get their garlic. Garlic is one of those absolutely amazing things. And again, if you go out, if you head out to a farmer's market tomorrow, see if you can find some. You can still get some from this season. So home cooks, you know, a couple of things you should know about garlic. Number one, it is an incredible food for boosting immunity. I mean, it's an antibacterial, it's an antifungal, it's an antivirus. And when you're using fresh garlic in the kitchen, it doesn't matter really if you chop it or press it or whatever, but it's got something called allicin in it, I've been told. And if you let's just say you chop the garlic, let it sit for 10, 15 minutes, it actually makes more allicin. So it actually becomes more healthful for you. And, you know, we grow garlic out at our farm. And there's a couple that I really like. I like, there's hundreds of types of garlics. And I really like Music, Georgian Crystal, Romanian Red, and German Porcelain. But to be honest with you, I've never had a garlic I didn't like. So, again, I can't emphasize enough, if you can get some local fresh garlic, buy it. And don't refrigerate it, because it's going to want to sprout. Just keep it in a cool, well-ventilated place.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Jennifer Rood-Klett about her new cookbook. It's called Home Cooking Comfort, more neighborly advice and recipes from the farm kitchen of a Midwestern food journalist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Well, are you a garlic fan too? Do you grow your own or buy it at a local farm stand or farmer's market? I'd love to hear what you like and what you're doing with it. In general, are you loving squash this time of year, as I am? That's one of my favorite fall ingredients. Do you have a question for Jennifer about how to cook with some of the great local produce that's going on? What is your favorite thing to cook this time of year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Find a few recipes from Jennifer at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Jennifer Rood-Klett. We're talking about fall seasonal cooking, home cooking, comfort food. Her new book is called Home Cooking Comfort, More Neighborly Advice and Recipes from the Farm Kitchen of a Midwestern Food Journalist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Looking to hear from fans of garlic and oats. And how about some lentils or any other fall produce here in Wisconsin that you love to cook, eat, maybe grow your own self? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find some recipes from our guest at WPR.org/Food Friday. Okay, we had fun with those cookies. Now let's get a salad in here. Jennifer, you gave us a apple arugula salad with fennel seeds and walnuts. Interesting combo.
Yeah, I really like this recipe because it's, even though it's wonderful to eat apples out of hand or slice them up with some good cheddar cheese, it's also nice to have a recipe with apples that's not fattening. Mm-hmm. And this recipe is absolutely incredibly off the charts healthful for you. It calls for either arugula or spinach leaves, one apple chopped into bite-sized pieces, celery, extra virgin olive oil or walnut oil. I kind of have been liking walnut oil lately. A little bit of honey, lemon. That's your dressing you're going to be pouring on. And then after that, you're going to be applying some walnut halves on top. And then I really like fennel seed, dried fennel seed. So sprinkle a little of that on top with some Parmesan cheese. And this is so incredibly good in the fall with pork or bacon, or anything, any pasta that's got a little bit of Parmesan in. This is a great accompaniment for that.
Find that recipe online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in Lac des Flambeaux. Mary, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to mention freezing garlic. I'm a big fan of America's Test Kitchen. They do all the testing, so we don't have to. And they've mentioned on a recent episode that freezing whole cloves, and then when you take it out of the freezer to use it, you can just grate it on like a microplane or, you know, the small holes of your grater. And I've done that because not all of us have a good way to store the wonderful garlic we get this time of year to keep it from sprouting. If you don't have a nice cool place for it, then freezing those whole cloves can be a good idea.
And Mary, we're peeling, I assume, the cloves before we freeze them? That'll make life easier, I bet.
I haven't.
Oh.
It's just not that much. I mean, when you grate a piece of garlic, if there's a little bit of the peel in there, by the time you're done cooking with it, it just doesn't matter.
Fair enough. Mary, thanks for sharing that. Freezing to keep that fresh garlic for the future.
Yeah, I had not heard of that. I think that's a wonderful idea. Anything you can do, but, you know, again, if you can score some local garlic, buy enough until next August. Seriously, if you've got the space to store it or you can stick it in the freezer, absolutely stock up, because you're going to really appreciate that in January or February or March when you're looking to make some simple pasta into something wonderful.
Thanks so much for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Jane joins us now in Shawano. Jane, hi.
Hi, hello.
What's your produce, Jane?
Well, I've just started this past few years growing butternut squash and acorn squash, and I was so happy when I realized how easy butternut squash soup was, and I love it. And I at least make it once or twice in the fall. And also my acorn squash, I was looking up recipes and I found that I didn't realize you could just slice it and eat it. And I thought, you know, with after you bake it with, you know, maple syrup or whatnot.
Oh, okay.
And,
yeah.
And I was really pleased, and it's easy to do and I love it. And that would be my comment.
And how much squash are you growing, Jane?
Just like one plant of each.
Okay.
Yeah, because we don't have a very big family. So, and also we have some friends that my husband works with that have fresh garlic, and I agree. Oh my gosh, very yummy.
Jane, thanks so much. I am a big squash fan. I have proven very bad at growing my own squash, though. Thanks for sharing that. What are your, Jennifer, what are some of your favorite ways to use squash in the fall?
You know, I kind of just bake it, cut it in half, and bake it. And you know, Jane mentioned maple syrup. I'm a huge fan of maple syrup, and we are really so spoiled and lucky that we live in Wisconsin. We have absolutely incredible food to choose from. There are incredible small maple syrup producers on all over the place. So that's something I really like with squash. I love squash. And another one I would suggest out there is delicata squash, which is among the easiest to, you know, scoop everything out and get it ready and throw it in the oven.
Yeah, and a big thing I'll do is cook down the squash, just bake it in halves, like you said, and then I'll let it cool, scoop it into a container, and so I try to have a freezer full to get me through the winter, then it's easy to get out for soup is mostly what I'll do with it.
And it makes good baby food, too.
Yeah, it's been a while, but yes, I imagine it would. It is Food Friday. We are talking to Jennifer Rood-Klett about her new cookbook. It's called Home Cooking Comfort, More Neighborly Advice and Recipes from the Farm Kitchen of a Midwestern Food Journalist. Well, I want to get to the third recipe you shared with us, speaking of soups, a French lentil soup. Okay, this sounds fancy. It's not too fancy for Rob, though?
No, you know Rob. You know me. There's no fancy here. These are all real world recipes. And so my soup recipes are, I am very devoted to my soup recipes because they kind of bring balance and comfort and normalcy back to my diet, especially after the holidays when you're indulging in all this high calorie food and parties and open houses and dinners. And so you get back to your standard soups. I probably make six soups that I rotate, and French lentil soup is just a great soup to make right now. It calls for carrots, celery, onion, a little garlic, and I like to use low sodium chicken broth. And I like French, you know, I am calling it French lentil soup. That is a little bit snobby here. But I will say, if you can score some French lentils, they're a little bit smaller and they kind of retain their texture a little bit more than normal brown lentils. But the brown lentils are absolutely fine too. But if you can get the French ones, go for it. There's also a little brown rice in here, some thyme, some cumin. And then at the end, when everything is cooked thoroughly, you throw in a little handful of chopped spinach and parsley, and it's just wonderful. And of course, it gets better with every reheat and goes great with some grilled cheese sandwiches or just some crusty bread. We are very partial to Madison sourdough, and so we typically have that with all of our soups.
Now, my favorite kind of soup that I make is, I call it fridge soup or freezer soup. I look and see what I have. See what's going to go bad soon, and then I work it into a soup. Do you have advice for people on, you know, not necessarily starting with the recipe, but starting with what do I got, what do I do with it?
Yeah, that this is one of my sayings, Rob. It's called move the merchandise in my kitchen. And I completely agree with what you just said, because I amaze myself that I've taken these things that I call half rotten. They're not really rotten, but you look in your fridge, what's got to go, you put it all in, and you're eating the soup, and you just can't believe how great it tastes.
Now, we just have a little bit of time left. I'm hoping you can give a pep talk to someone out there who might be listening, thinking, I wish I cooked more. I didn't really learn much growing up. What advice do you have for them to take the first couple of steps to home cooking?
I think it's important to remember that with home cooking, or with food, actually, you control everything you eat. And you can't say that about much in life. And I encourage people to think of it this way, that be the boss of your kitchen. You're in charge. Command and control. And allow yourself some time to calmly decide how you're going to feed yourself.
And you, just in our last half minute or so, you have a lot of fun cooking. And I know sometimes it can be stressful when you're trying to cook under a deadline. How do you keep it fun for yourself?
Oh, you just have to have a sense of humor with everything, Rob. But yeah, there is a little bit of pressure when you're a food writer and a food journalist, knowing that you have to make something and then you have to take a picture of it. And not only do you have to get the recipe right and it's got to be good, but that picture has got to be spot on.
Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
My pleasure.
That's Jennifer Rudklatt, a freelance writer focused on Midwestern history, gardening, and food. We talked to her on this week's edition of Food Friday about her new cookbook. It's called Home Cooking Comfort, more neighborly advice and recipes from the farm kitchen of a Midwestern food journalist. You can find a few of the recipes she shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. We got those oat cookies with brown butter cinnamon frosting, the French lentil soup, but it's not too fancy, and the apple arugula salad with fennel seeds and walnuts, all again at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, political campaign ads. I've seen a few. There's a good chance. So have you. Kate and her guest look at political advertising this midterm season, negative ads along the way. You can join in to tell us what you're seeing and what you're getting sick of. That's coming up Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the latest from Brazil as voters get ready to cast their ballots in a key presidential election, plus news from China, Iran, and the war in Ukraine, all on the Friday News Roundup today at 6 on 1A+. Now, coming into this midterm election year, the expectation was that Republicans had a decent chance to take control of the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. Could be a close call. That's in part because the party in the White House tends to lose seats in Congress in midterms. Now, months and millions of dollars in advertising later, it looks like Republicans have a decent chance to take control of the House, and the Senate is a close call. There's a lot at stake when it comes to control of Congress and a huge mix of issues that could influence voters. And while we, of course, don't know the results of the 2022 midterms, we're going to spend some time talking about what could happen in Congress depending on the outcomes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you have your eye on when it comes to midterm races? If Republicans take control of the House, Senate, or both, what are you hoping they do? What are you fearing they do? Same question if Democrats retain control of Congress. What thoughts do you have? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Julia Azari has been thinking a lot about this, teaching about it too. She's a professor of political science at Marquette University. She researches and teaches about the American presidency and political parties. She's authored the book Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate. Julia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we hear in many elections, this is among the most consequential of our lifetime, or phrases to that effect. How consequential, how important is this particular 2022 midterm election for Congress?
So I think there's sort of two answers to that question. One has to do with what kind of policies will come out of Congress if we have a divided government after this election. And I think there, you know, the question there is, what kinds of policies could we imagine a Republican White House or excuse me, Republican House run led by Speaker Kevin McCarthy of California is kind of the presumptive candidate for that, and a Biden White House, regardless of who controls the Senate. I think the answer of what they might work on together is not very much. So I think we'll see something, if that happens, very similar to what we saw in the Obama years, where there's some brinksmanship over budget politics, where there's a lot of disagreement. There's a lot of messaging bills, a lot of kind of symbolic politics, knowing that very little will go forward. I think, you know, symbolically, and also in the realm of kind of some of the concerns that people have about the future of American democracy, we're going to see some really difficult questions come forward if this happens about how a Republican-led House kind of addresses some of the concerns that people had following the 2020 election. Do they follow what has become kind of standard opinion in the Republican Party about that election? Do they act on that in any way with regard to future elections? What will be their capacity to do that? So I don't want to downplay the very real, both symbolic and kind of really concrete consequences that can have. From a policy perspective, I think we're looking at, you know, the possibility of a very deadlocked, divided government if that's what happens in November.
I understand you've been talking to your students about a similar situation. Again, a Democratic president, and if Republicans controlled the House, going back to 1994, I believe that was the Contract with America year, where you had a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, Republicans led by Newt Gingrich in the House. What lessons could we take from that?
Yeah, great question. I'm really excited to be dragging my students into what to them will feel like ancient history on Tuesday, which to me feels like fairly recent memory. 1994. So the Contract with America, what's interesting about that is that was a real kind of turn in congressional elections to really thinking about them as a kind of national event where people in different districts and states were running under kind of a similar banner. And the Contract with America really was kind of a House of Representatives thing. This year, the Republicans have sort of done something similar with a document called Commitment to America that has kind of their ideas about the state of the country and what they would do. There's a couple of interesting, so a key lesson, I think, is that not actually that many people are going to pay attention to this in the broader electorate. And now we think about this kind of national dimension as pretty natural part of elections. We would expect members of the same party to be on a similar kind of page. One thing that I thought was really striking from the Contract with America is that it largely avoided a lot of social issues, even though that was part of that campaign, was taking on what Bill Clinton had done in regard to social issues. But the document itself was really about economics, and it was kind of about governmental reform, changing the way things were done in Congress. This year, you know, the Commitment to America does not shy away from these kind of divisive social issues. And I think that really shows you how much party politics has changed since then.
Talking to Julia Azari from Marquette University, looking at what's at stake in the midterm elections for control of Congress. Both chambers up for grabs. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, predictions, worries, questions. 800-642-1234 is the number. Tom joins us now in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think in the past when we had presidents and the rest of the government in different houses, like Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, for example, those are people in times when people could actually compromise and get together. But right now, we're looking at people like Kevin McCarthy and his cohorts basically saying that they're just going to let Donald Trump get away with armed insurrection. And they also want to use impeachment against Joe Biden and other people, Kamala Harris. And it just seems extreme to the extent where I really think democracy is in danger.
Tom, thanks for the call. Julia, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some pretty striking polling lately that shows that this is a widespread feeling among Americans, but also that people don't really have a sense of what to do about it. That's very striking to me. I think that the caller is kind of laying out a sense that a lot of people have. And certainly, you know, if you've been watching the January 6th hearings and you have been kind of following what that committee, a sort of bipartisan committee, has been trying to do, it's, you know, a Republican House is not going to pick up on that work. It's just, that's just not going to happen. And I think that, you know, you always have kind of some seesawing between the two parties, but, you know, I think there are people who see that really as something much larger and having like a much longer term impact hanging in the balance. Impeachment, I think, is going to come up a lot. And I think it's important to think about impeachment as a kind of as something that reflects the politics going on in Congress. If the Democrats hold the Senate, which the Senate is anybody's guess, then obviously, a Republican House impeaching Biden, that those charges then won't really go anywhere in the Senate. And so I think it's important to think about what the political calculus will be for members of the House to do that. And on the one hand, it might be worth it to kind of do that in a messaging way and then say, look, these people didn't do anything. On the other hand, I think the reason we, even though we have this incredible partisan rancor, we don't see more impeachment efforts is because impeachment really is, I think, still seen as very kind of politically fraught and potentially very costly process.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I wanted to ask you about one possible tactic for a Republican-led chamber, one or both. The debt ceiling. And we've seen leading Republicans, including you mentioned likely Speaker, if the Republicans won the House, Kevin McCarthy, saying, yeah, we're probably going to use the threat of a shutdown over a vote on the debt ceiling to extract policy concessions as opposed to, you know, trying to just pass things that a president's going to veto. How important is that?
So it's hard to know at the outset exactly what these dynamics will be like, but that was certainly what we saw during the Obama years. And I think that one thing that's sort of critical about that is that it's really not evident that anyone paid a political price for that sort of budget kind of showdown that happened over the course of Obama's kind of the latter part of his first term in particular. And there was a, you know, very close to kind of crisis in the summer of 2011. And that was, you know, it wasn't really clear that the electorate honestly reacted very strongly to that, either to say, yes, we want to see more the sort of budget austerity, or no, we were very concerned about the U.S. defaulting on its debt. The policy consequences for the latter are something you should ask somebody who knows more about the global political economy. But my understanding is it's quite dire. This is not a joke. But I think that kind of really high stakes sort of party conflict was not uncommon in the Obama years. I can think of reasons why that might not be the tactic this time around. For all the kind of public politics has been every bit as nasty as it was in the Obama years, the sort of congressional actual legislating has been a little bit more bipartisan with the Biden administration. So you can imagine that might not necessarily be the case, but, you know, I don't really have any reason to believe either that the politics between the two parties will be a lot calmer, than it has been in the past, or that anyone will shy away from very, like I said, very high stakes, kinds of tactics.
We're talking to political science professor Julia Azari from Marquette University, looking at the midterm elections and what's at stake depending on which party emerges with control of one or both chambers of commerce. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the most important things you see being at stake when it comes to which party controls Congress? What do you hope to see? What do you worry about depending on who ends up winning the control of the House in particular or the Senate? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the midterm elections and the stakes for which party or parties control the House and Senate. Julia Azari stays with us, professor of political science at Marquette University. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts, hopes, fears, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now with Justin in Algoma. Justin, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. My question for Professor Azara, is this a good time for a gridlock? If the Republicans win both houses, is it time for the states to step up and be a little bit less politically divided?
Interesting, Justin. If we can't get things done at the federal level, is this a time where states will take the forefront?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of agnostic on that question. I think there are ways in which when the states step up, that can be good. There's kind of clear ways that, you know, states have a lot of variety in the kinds of policies they might need. There's other ways where that can be really chaotic and, you know, lead to a kind of situation in which you need some kind of central federal policy or where that becomes a way to make life worse for some people. So I think that really depends. I have been in the past, like, somewhat of a defender of gridlock in the sense that if the country is sort of split on something, then, you know, we should figure out a way to do something that a lot of people can agree on. The problem with that I see right now is something that people in the political science community have been talking about for some years now, which is this idea that what's driving the disagreement between the two parties isn't just issue disagreement. And you can have a really different position on an issue and still come to some agreement about what the problem is and find a compromise solution that doesn't do everything that anybody wants, but that does some things for kind of a wide range of people and that improves things on balance for as many people as possible. That is a thing that can happen, but it can't really happen when the two parties are fundamentally seeing each other as enemies. And there are people who have arguments about the way that this might not be symmetrical between the two parties. I don't think I have time to sort of go over all the different evidence, but it's clear that's part of the equation here is that it's not that there's gridlock because there's always disagreement on issues. It's that there's gridlock because one side doesn't want to hand the other side a win. And they see it as an opportunity for gain, an advantageous thing for them to kind of sabotage the other side. And that's, I think, sort of across a lot of different viewpoints among scholars and journalists in the political realm. That's the thing that I think we see is really, is really damaging to the governing process. That just makes governing impossible.
Justin, thanks for the call. Dennis joins us now in Two Rivers. Dennis, hello.
Yeah, that's what I was getting into is they kind of be like Groucho Marx. If the other side is for it, they're against it. Because sometimes, I mean, one example is when Trump was in office, he wanted to be sure he got his signature on the checks that went out to us. But then when the Democrats are in charge and they're sending out checks, then the Republicans are totally against it. So it just depends on whose idea it is and who's in charge.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Dennis referred to Groucho Marx as Rufus T. Firefly in the movie Duck Soup. But that, whatever it is, I'm against it. Negative polarization shaping actions for voters and for members of Congress, Dennis says, Julia.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if I could have put it better. That's a really good example. What's interesting about that is that in the previous administration and also in this one, there have actually been things that have come out of Congress where they've managed to come up with some points of agreement. There was a kind of, I guess I would call it, it was a gun bill, but it was kind of like a broad context gun bill over the summer that dealt a lot with like mental health type of issues. And that was bipartisan. You had bipartisan infrastructure. You have the COVID relief and both administrations has had some support. That's just, you know, this is the thing I think that a lot of people are finding very frustrating is that certainly when you go out into the electorate, Republicans and Democrats have different viewpoints. They have reasons for their beliefs, but they also have concerns that they share in common and the possibility for compromise. And the current structure of our politics just is not is not terribly conducive to that, and there aren't a lot of political incentives for that. And that seems to be the sort of catch-22 that we are stuck in. And that, again, I think is kind of what we're looking at when it comes to thinking about a possible divided government in 2023. So, I mean, I think that that's also something people can think about. As far as those political incentives, members of Congress behave the way they do because they think that, that's what they have, that's what's in their best political interest. And voters have some power there. And, you know, joining up with other people to kind of pressure members of Congress on to compromise on important issues, that can work. I think that is probably the only thing that does work. And so I do want to sort of emphasize how I hear the frustration in each caller's, each caller's comments and voice, but also to emphasize that we are still part of this equation as citizens.
Thanks for the call, Dennis. I want to spend a little bit of time, Julia, on we've been talking about after the election and the what ifs. What might shape the outcomes? I won't ask you to make any predictions because who can really do that? But what are you watching for that could swing outcomes in one way or another?
Yeah, I mean, I think this has been really a challenging couple of years in this regard because it's not totally obvious what shapes outcomes. The polls this fall look like they have shifted a lot toward the Republicans. Even that, there's a debate among experts about whether that's just a matter of shifting to looking at likely voters as opposed to just registered voters over the summer. That often is sort of a Republican shift. In terms of what happens in the next couple of weeks, honestly, the main thing I'm looking at is mobilization, is how the two sides are mobilizing their voters. And the last two elections, 2020 and 2018, have had very high turnout. And that turnout has been, those increases have been pretty even across the two parties. So it might be a wash. It certainly was in 2020. But I'll be looking at that because I think that's really the main thing that is going to make a difference now. I don't know that the things that the candidates are saying or doing is making a big difference at this point.
Over the last bunch of months since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the Dobbs decision, we've seen a few elections, a referendum in Kansas, a couple of special House elections where there was kind of a hidden phenomenon, it seemed like, in the polling of younger women in particular becoming likely voters where pollsters might not have considered them that in the past. Do you think that's something that might hold in 2 weeks?
Yeah, I don't know. I've been puzzling a lot about this, and people have now been sharing early voting data to the extent it's available in Pennsylvania, here in Wisconsin, that I think does show a little bit of an advantage for women voters in Wisconsin. I'm very hesitant to put too much stock in this sort of partial data, early voting data. But I think that you might see, if there's that effect, I think it's likely to be small. That said, a lot of these races are really close. And the generic ballot for the House of Representatives is basically even. There's a number of critical races in the Senate, like six of those, that are just incredibly close. In a close election, anything can matter, and a small change can make the difference. So I think that's the case. I do think what we're seeing in Senate races and in governor's races is that in this sort of bigger race than a House race, that there's just a more complex set of issues. Similarly with the Kansas referendum, which was very direct, it was very clear what people were voting on. And in a Senate race, we can pick up on a lot more different factors and dynamics, and so that might at least partially crowd out that issue.
Julia, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Julia Azari, professor of political science at Marquette University, author of the book Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate, with us for a look at the midterm elections and what's at stake when it comes to which party ends up controlling the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing a case on affirmative action in college. We'll check out the arguments and find out what's at stake for higher education and beyond. That plus some ghost stories coming up Monday here on Central Time.